Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to Bugle issue 125 for the week beginning Monday, the 30th of August 2010, with me, Andy Zaltzman, three-time winner of the Bugle Greatest Show of the Edinburgh Fringe Awards 2008, 2009, 2010. Big hat-trick for the young Lapsju, particularly impressive given that he didn't even do a show at last year's Fringe. And in New York City, it's the man who has now been runner-up three agonising years in a row. It's the no-time winner of the Bugle Fringe Award, John, the Alan Key of Truth, Oliver.
Hello, Andy. Hello, Buglers. Andy, there's some late breaking news.
Oh, that sounds good.
That you might be interested in. Just yesterday, three men were arrested in Ottawa for alleged involvement in a terror cell that was plotting attacks on Canadian soil. Now, the new detail is that one of them, Khurram Sher, had actually auditioned for Canadian Idol back in 2008, where he had sung an off-key version of Avril Lavigne's Complicated. I guess that's where he developed his grudge against the West. And I suppose Avril's lyrics were an early red flag for us. It just, as she says, why do you have to go and make things so complicated? I see the way you're acting like you're somebody else gets me frustrated. I suppose that speaks to the capitalist world overcomplicating life, Andy, and the fact that we're acting like someone who doesn't abide by the strictest interpretation of Sharia law. That's obviously made him frustrated. It was all there, Andy. We must learn from this, and I guess two things have to happen immediately. Firstly, Avril Lavigne has to be arrested. Her songs are clearly code. I don't know who, incidentally, Skater Boy is, but the command, "See you later, boy," seems to imply some kind of suicide attack. Also, anyone voted off these talent shows in the future must be taken immediately to Guantanamo Bay until they can conclusively prove they are not a threat to the West. It's certainly going to add some more excitement to next seasons of Britain's Got Talent and Jihadists.
I mean, do you think, this joining the terrorist hell was triggered by the well-documented Lavigne-Whibley breakup?
I don't know where Whibley stands on it. I mean, maybe Derek Whibley was just... Yeah. Maybe he fell out with her over the very extreme content of her lyrics.
I do know that Sum 41's last album was dedicated to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the al-Qaeda honcho. I don't know if you can read anything into that, John.
I don't know, Andy.
Yeah. So, this is Bugle 125, which means, John, we are an eighth of the way to 1,000 Bugles.
Wow.
But more importantly, we are 0.0125% of the way to the historic millionth Bugle.
That's the big one.
What an event that's going to be, John. So here's a date for your diaries, Buglers. I reckon it's going to be around about the 10th of July in the year 25,263.
Oh, man. You're going to be so dead by then, Andy.
Well,
dead.
It's going to be about 705 generations from now, John, by my calculation, assuming we reproduce at the age of 33, roughly, which is about what I did, I think. Yeah. And how old are you now? You're, what, are you 30, 33 now?
33, Andy, yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, get a move on, mate. Anyway, I've run a computer simulation, John. It suggests that the millionth Bugle will be recorded in outer space... Right. Somewhere near the Andromeda Gallery.
Okay.
Andromeda. Oh, yeah. Don't give in to the urges. And that's just the constellation. Don't get me started on the mythological Greek hottie. Change to a rock to be devoured by a sea monster. Oh, you like the kinky stuff, do you? Yowgers! Focus. Right, we can't unleash that Pandora's box again. The names of the people recording the millionth Bugle will be Buglax Badonkadonk Zaltzman and John Oliver the 706th.
Yes. And don't let me down.
Since you're American now, John, I know that's how you people name your children these days.
Yeah, that's right.
It will be broadcast telepathically to every single person in the universe, whether they like it or not. The president of the USA at that time will be the radical cleric Mullah Abdul al-Thalika. Started with letting Barack Obama in, John. You can't close that box when it's open. And the language it will be recorded in will be Pidgin French, which, due to a clerical error, will have become the only legal language in the universe. So something for you lot to look forward to. This is Bugle 125. That's five cubed, John. Mm-hmm. This is the first Bugle to be a cube of an integer since Bugle 64.
And I can hardly bring
myself to say this, but it's going to be the last cuboid Bugle until Bugle 216.
Wow.
When they used to be two a penny, of course. You think back, Bugles 1, 8, 27. Those were really the glory days. But then the troubles began. They started drying up. And after this week, there's only going to be one more in the next 5 years. I mean,
I've drifted off,
what's, what's the point of going on? Well, it tells you something about life, doesn't it? All what I'm essentially saying by that is we're all going to die. 125, also the maximum number of nuts squirrels illegally allowed to hoard in Canada. That is legislation for legislation's sake, isn't it? And how are they going to enforce it? The cost of issuing the search warrants doesn't even cover the money you can make from auctioning off any excess nuts. Besides, these bastards have no respect for the law, and they're mostly innumerate. Quite apart from 125 being a very difficult number to count for animals with only four toes on each front leg. Is this what our elected representatives are supposed to be legislating on, John? No. Point proved. And this is the Bugle for the week beginning. It's been a long festival. Monday the 30th of August. So here's an interesting thing about the 30th of August, John. Nothing in history has ever happened on a 30th of August in the whole of history combined. It's the least eventful day of the year, which is why you so rarely see people with tattoos saying, "I love the 30th of August," indelibly scrawled across their faces. As always, the section of Bugle's going straight in the bin. This week, an economy home tanning section. Holidays are out these days, what with the credit crunch, and not wanting to look like we're trivialising the sacrifices made by our troops in two world wars less than a century ago. And fake tan is really little more than a living lie in a bottle. So we road test a range of economy household varnishes to see which can give you the most realistic and lasting tan without permanently disfiguring your skin or turning you into a piece of wood. And also in the bin, a supplement on safety clothing, including the Attenti boot. Fashionable ankle boots with electronic sensors that bleep loudly when you're about to stub your toe on something. Not recommended for use when rock climbing or kickboxing. Also available is the limited edition Celebrity Attenti boot, in which the voice of one of five celebrities warns that when you're about to stub your toe, ranging from Charlie Sheen saying, "Look out, Mr. Toe, you're about to take a clunking," to Greta Garbo sultrily honking, "Oh my, that slightly raised paving slab could do you a mischief." And also,
is that your Greta Garbo impression?
Well, it's my first go at it, John. You know, it takes professional impressionists a few weeks at least to master these.
Well, let's check back in to see how your Greta's got in the next 3 weeks, Andy.
Well, I don't know. I just haven't spoken to her for ages, so it's hard to remember exactly. You forget her voices, don't you?
Yeah.
And the Bellmits. That's half helmet, half decommissioned church bell, which emits a loud clang when you're struck on the head by hard objects. Does not prevent injury, in fact, it may exacerbate it due to the weight of the Bellmit, but it does alert passers-by more quickly to knockout blows.
Top story this week. God said to Pakistan, there's going to be a floody, floody. Pakistan said what? Again? Fuck you, buddy, buddy. What a fucking mess. You wouldn't know.
Did you write that specially, John? Was that an adaptation of an existing classic?
It's the adaptation of God Said to Noah, there's going to be a floody, floody, Andy.
Oh, right.
You wouldn't know. You wouldn't know about that.
Well, no.
Noah doesn't play a key role in your life. as a hue, as I believe the Spanish pronounce you. You wouldn't know it by looking at the news, Andy, but Pakistan is still currently experiencing a humanitarian crisis on a near unfathomable scale. Or certainly on a scale that the media doesn't seem remotely interested in fathoming in any public shape or form. In fact, the media seems to be dealing with this flood as if it's an unruly wasp at a family picnic. Just ignore it and I'm sure it'll go away. Don't get all dramatic about it, it's just nature. According to the UN, who now currently seem to be less of a body brokering peace worldwide and more archivists for international misery, apparently more than 17 million people have been affected by the floods, and about 1.2 million homes have been destroyed, leaving 5 million people homeless. Andy, UN Secretary Ban Ki-moon must answer his first phone call every morning when he sits down at his desk with, "Hello? What now? What the f*** has happened now? Can I just eat my bagel and check my emails? Can I just do that before you tell me what disaster has just befell mankind? I f***ing hate this f***. King job. If I go home and Mrs. Ki-moon asks me one more time, how was work today, dear? I'm going to lose my shit. How was work today, dear? It was f***ing harrowing, sweetheart. Thanks for asking. How is it being married to a shell of a human being? That is what I imagine his secretary hears muffled through his office wall every morning, Andy. There is no way that Ban Ki-moon doesn't swear. Not in that job. You might go into it as a non-swearer, but that must change by the first afternoon, when you're presented with a file on what's happening in Somalia, and the only words available in your head to you are, holy shit.
Do you know that the key in Ban Ki-moon is actually short for Keith?
I didn't know that, Andy.
His name's Ban Keith Moon. And, really? Yeah. His father was vehemently opposed to 1960s rock drummers.
Right.
I'm 35. But it's a rhythm of life as old as time itself, John. Natural disaster leads to humanitarian catastrophe. Mm-hmm. Leads to international squabble over exactly who should be doing and giving what to whom. And there's been a lot of unhappiness about the lack of international response, lack of donations from Muslim countries, and also the lack of assistance from the Almighty Lord, or Lords, or Lords and Ladies himself and or themselves. Still not really on top of their game, John. The Lords, in any of their many guises, really letting these natural disasters slam home the goals with alarming regularity at the moment. Maybe the Lords' inbox is full, John, because tends to hit quite holy parts of the world pretty hard. And
yes.
I can only imagine all prayers are now just rebounding back unheard and unheeded. So let's hope it's just a career lull, John. Bit like Brian Lara in the right about the turn of the millennium.
It is strange how sluggish donations have been, relatively coming in from private citizens, businesses and governments all around the world. And I was reading some of the reasons that some experts have suggested for this. One, there's a recession. No, and that is true. Pakistan have stupidly picked a very bad time to be hit by a natural disaster. What were they thinking, Andy? They may have made the same crucial mistake as the population of New Orleans 5 years ago, who had forgotten both that America's armed forces were fighting two wars abroad, and also that the government didn't really give a shit about them. Two, trust seems to be an issue. There does seem to be a concern that the local population are being radicalised by Taliban forces who are helping them. But come on. We're talking about 20 million people who need help, and the word terrorism does not even exist in Surakai and Sindhi, the two languages of the majority of the people who've been rendered homeless. And I don't think they really give a rat's shit whether they're getting supplies from a UN worker, a Taliban militant, or John Travolta in a Scientology hovercraft. The third is the donor fatigue. And with the tsunami, the 2005 Pakistan earthquake, the earthquake recently in Haiti, Dr. Elizabeth Ferris, who's apparently the senior fellow at the US-based Brookings Institute, a foreign policy think tank, said, it should also be noted that the international humanitarian system isn't set up to deal with more than one major crisis a year. USA, for example, committed one-third of its annual budget to the Haitian earthquake response. Well, maybe we should just treat ourselves and splurge on a humanitarian system that can deal with more than just one crisis a year. Either that, or we should be very, very clear. If you insist on having a natural disaster, you are strongly advised to do it in the first 6 months of the year, just to be safe. And finally, the disaster itself. Apparently, floods are a very bad choice. And Ban Keith Moon, described them as a tsunami in slow motion. And the professor of economics at Yale said, sudden events seem to generate more funds. A flood and droughts happen gradually and build. There isn't any single day in which news is huge. And for the same reason, this pushes the story away from the media spotlight. But massive and sudden earthquakes or tsunamis draw our immediate attention and shock us. Well, I hope you're listening, Pakistan. Your suffering just hasn't been spectacular enough. Please send an official letter to the UN apologising for boring everyone.
They just need to get a good publicist, John. I'll get Max Clifford or someone.
I think that's really what they need.
Get it on the front pages.
Yeah. You
know. This donor fatigue, it apparently is a genuine issue, and I think maybe you're right. Maybe we should just store it up until the end of each calendar year, and then all the different natural disasters should have a televised weep-off to see which case is the most heart-rending.
That seems to be what people would prefer.
Yeah, because, I mean, we have to choose at the moment. You know, I'd love to help, John, but, you know, if I give £50 to the Pakistan flood relief, then I can't give £50 to the fund to have Pat Robertson, Glenn Beck and the Dutch footballer Mark van Bommel fired into space in a special rocket. What a sitcom that would be.
Oh, boy.
And I can't even then spend £50 on petrol for my car to help BP get back on its feet. Don't mock, you know, because of the oil spill, John, they've ended up spending around £30 billion on the environment that no other oil company will have spent. So These are tough choices, John. Yeah. And there was something interesting. This, I did a small benefit gig in Edinburgh for the Pakistan Flood Relief, organised by my Edinburgh flatmate Simon Munnery. It's part of the Free Fringe. So there was no entry fee, and there was a bucket at the end. And it was in this tiny little room, a 45-seat venue. People absolutely crammed into an obvious fire trap, which I guess is what the Fringe is all about. And anyway, they'd seen... I was the bucket wielder at the end, collecting the donations on the way. And these people had seen a strong bill. They'd seen Simon Munnery himself... A guru, a legend of the British comedy scene. They've seen me, the three-time winner of the Bugle Greatest Comedy Show of the Fringe Awards. Uh-huh. They've seen Kevin Eldon, long-standing Leviathan of British TV sitcoms and sketch shows. And Carl Barron, the Ayers Rock of stand-up. In other words, he's huge in Australia. it's a very strong bill not to have to pay to get into. And some of these people walked out without putting a f***ing penny in the bucket. One group of four put 10 quid in and walked out saying, "This is for all of us." Another guy quite clearly puts an empty hand into the bucket and clanks the coins around as if it was a church collection plate. And he was a committed Zionist. he was holding his fingers in a way that no one who'd actually ever held money in their fingers would ever hold them. Another guy, people were chucking in 10 or 20 pence. One guy walked straight past and I said to him, "You haven't put any money here." And he replied with a grin that really deserved to be wiped off his face in a thoroughly physical manner. "Sorry," he said, "I forgot to bring any money with me." Oh. And I pointed out to him that he had come f***ing badly prepared for a charity fundraising gig. But with hindsight, I think we should have been better organised for the collection. We should have actually had a Pakistani child there and a bath full of water. And if anyone did not put in a reasonable donation, we should have taken them to one side and said, "Go on then, see this through, hold little Imran's face under the water until the twitching stops." Because that is essentially what you are doing, you tight-fisted chancer and charlatan. And while you're at it, here is Imran's parents' one remaining cow, and here is a baseball bat. I think you know what to do. Get stuck in. So, Bugles, this behaviour cannot be tolerated. I know if any of you had been at this gig, you would have given generously. But there were non-Buglers there who did not, and therefore I encourage you all to right this wrong by going up to anyone you see who isn't clearly listening to the Bugle, grabbing them by their collar and or lapels, and haranguing them right in their faces about being disrespectful cheapskates who deserve to be birched. Of course, the chances are the person you're haranguing won't have been at this gig and responsible for the non-donations, but there is a small chance that they will have been, and we cannot afford to miss that chance. And if innocent people have to suffer an unjustified personal blasting in the process, that is a price worth paying to preserve the dignity of the poor people of Pakistan.
One of the side issues with this disaster is that in the vacuum that follows a crisis like this terrible flood, extremist groups often like to try to provide badly needed assistance to the badly hit communities. On one hand, this is good news. You know, they're able to mobilise quickly to help some of the most impoverished regions on earth. Hamas supporters did it very effectively in Gaza recently. And you end up having the international community in these groups kind of competing to see who can be the most compassionate. For a moment, you can find yourself thinking, could it be that natural disasters bring out the best in terrorists? But then, on the other two hands, the bad in these extremists quickly bobs back up to the surface like a particularly buoyant witch. The UN is currently having to review security measures for its aid workers in Pakistan after receiving warnings from the Pakistan Taliban, who it seems are planning to attack foreigners delivering aid to the millions of people affected. And one Taliban spokesman told the Associated Press, "The presence of foreign aid workers was unacceptable." See, just when you think they can't go any lower, Andy, they excavate the moral low ground down just a few more feet. Attacking international, non-political aid workers, bringing emergency supplies to a disaster zone. Surely, if a terrorist found himself about to launch an attack on these incredibly brave, dedicated, selfless people, he must find himself pausing for a moment to ask himself, hold on, these people do seem to be doing a lot of good here. Let me just check. Am I a holy warrior? Or am I a misguided c***? I think I know the answer, but I'm just not 100%.
Also, you think if the money spent on the Burj Khalifa in Dubai, the half a f***ing mile f***ing high skyscraper discussed in previous Bugles, had been spent on, for example, flood defences in Pakistan, well, I mean, the world might have been all the poorer for not knowing what happens when a group of people with a crap load of money and a walnut full of sense get together and phone an architect. But $1.5 billion that cost, John, and the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs was calling for $460 million of aid for the flood that has affected over 15 million people. So that kind of puts it in context. The fountain system at the Burj Khalifa cost $217 million. So that is almost half the aid. So I guess it turns out that water is expensive, whatever your delivery system.
Traffic news now, and if you were driving on the Beijing Tibet Expressway this week, then you will have found yourself in the Mother Teresa of all traffic jams. On Monday, thousands upon thousands of vehicles were snuffed up in more than a 62-mile jam that lasted for over a week. The road slowed down to a crawl back on August the 14th from a combination of a spike in cargo-bearing trucks heading towards Beijing, and major road maintenance. Now, how would you have handled that, Andy? Because I've seen you in a traffic jam, and you can lose your shit fast. It's not like Beijing has the equivalent of the A101. You've got no option but to stay there.
Well, yeah, I mean, in 9 days, this traffic jam, that's time to go to the moon and back, and still have plenty of time looking around for the remnants of Neil Armstrong's dog. Let's put that in context. And there must have been some games of I Spy with My Little Eye that were really struggling for new spying objects. But I am, as you say, a bit of an aficionado of how to behave in a traffic jam. And I've done an anatomy of traffic jam behaviour for you. So if in case any buglers find yourself in a 9-day traffic jam, this is what you can expect to happen to you. Day one, mild frustration, building slowly into finger-twitching rage, before exploding into steering wheel headbutting fury, shouting, for f***ing f*** sake, I've got to get to my f***ing knitting class or I'm never going to f***ing learn f***ing cross-stitch. Day two, wake up in a fug of confusion. Spend the day largely in a state of resignation, muttering incoherently about jam proves the existence of God, and that Jesus basically spent 40 days in a traffic jam when he was in the wilderness. In fact, according to the recently discovered gospel according to St. Nigel, he was stuck in roadworks on the Jericho bypass. The first of three times, in fact, that Jesus uttered the famous words, Father, why have you forsaken me? The third time famous his legendary crucifixion gig. The second time during karaoke after the Last Supper when he couldn't remember the words to I am what I am. He never used to look at the words on the screen, John. It's a matter of personal pride. Right. Anyway, day three, you're feeling murderous. You've start visualising killing drivers of surrounding cars in increasingly bizarre ways, concluding with a waking daydream about feeding a lorry driver to a whale, then beaching the whale, then blowing it up, exploding whale-style, then hunting down the remaining bits of the driver, sewing them back together, steamrolling it, and feeding it through an office shredder. Day four, hysteria. Spend the entire day standing on the car roof pretending to be Swedish tennis player Mats Wilander during his legendary 1995 French Open final victory over Ivan Lendl. Day five, psychological numbness. Spend the entire day clutching the steering wheel, shouting, vroom, vroom, vroom. Day six, Stockholm Syndrome. The near week of captivity makes you fall passionately in love with your own car. Spend the morning whispering sweet nothings into the glove compartment, then the afternoon worrying about whether the car fancies you back, before at 7 p.m. unbuttoning the top two buttons of your shirt and or blouse, leaning over the steering wheel suggestively and saying, oh, come on, it's funky time. Day seven, return to normality. Pretend you are in fact exactly where you want to be when you wanted to be there. The car is your office and you're supposed to be there. Hold a board meeting in which you tell the gear stick that you want a 15% productivity increase over the next fiscal quarter. Shout at the electric windows that they aren't a team player and this business has no room for passengers before realising the irony of your comments and tearing out the air conditioning unit and saying, you are so fired. Spend the afternoon pretending to do unnecessary paperwork and honking the horn like a buzzer and asking your secretary, the rearview mirror in this case, to bring in a cup of coffee. Day 8, womb fantasy. You become convinced that you have not been born yet. The car is, in fact, your mother's womb. You tear the seatbelt off its moorings, stick it on your belly button and pretend it's your umbilical cord. You play Beethoven on the car radio to increase your intellectual development for when you do finally get out of the car, and repeatedly kick the windscreens, doors and roof of the car to make it clear you are nearly ready to be born. Day 9, finally get moving and go home. Stare right through your family with a faraway look before saying, I'm just going to nip to the shops to get some milk, before getting back in your car, driving at breakneck speed back to the end of the traffic jam and rejoining it while shouting, it's the only life I know, and I might get an Edinburgh show out of this.
The amazing thing is that apparently quite a community was forged over the week. People were going from car to car, chatting, and you know, I imagine saying things like, can you believe this shitting traffic jam? People were showering there on the road, and a mini economy was formed with local merchants capitalising on the stranded driver predicament by selling them water and food at inflated prices. See, China, isn't capitalism fun? All you need is a weakness and a supply and demand situation, and you can run hog wild. Drop the commie act, China. You've clearly got bitten by the profit bug. Wouldn't it be amazing if the one thing to finally pull China out of communism was a traffic jam? Traffic in Beijing has been getting worse and worse for years. Average driving speeds in the capital could drop below 9 miles an hour if residents keep buying at the current rates of 2,000 new cars a day. At that pace, Beijing will have 7 million cars by 2015, and transportation will slow down to what it was decades ago when China was known as the Bicycle Kingdom. So they've gone full circle, Andy, from bikes to cars that travel at the speed of bikes.
Well, in London, in fact, I think I read a stat a while ago, or I might have just invented it, but I don't have the internet in this studio, so I can't even check it. But in London, the average traffic speed in central London is slower than it was before the invention of the car.
Really?
Yeah. It's basically slower than a horse and cart.
Oh, no.
Albeit leaving slightly less shit on the ground behind it.
But just 2 days ago, the traffic jam apparently vanished. French news agency AFP said that virtually overnight, local authorities had dispersed the congestion. And why is it that when the Chinese authorities manage to vanish something virtually overnight, you start to worry where that something actually is now? Have any of these vehicles actually got home yet? Does anyone know where they are? Or is there a mysterious, massive, freshly cultivated field by the side of the road where the traffic jam was that has a few number plates sticking out of the ground?
Or more likely, a large hydroelectric dam.
Putin takes another step towards becoming late 80s Sylvester Stallone news now. And look, I'm just going to come out and say this, Andy, rather than talking around it. The simplicity of this story is where the real joy is. Here goes. And by the way, buglers, if you're carrying an expensive vase at the moment, you might want to find somewhere safe to put it down. This week, Vladimir Putin shot a whale with a crossbow. Let me repeat that, because there are three key components there. Vladimir Putin shot a whale with a crossbow. Let me explain it in a different context like this. Last week, we were living in a world where Vladimir Putin had not yet shot a whale with a crossbow.
You don't know that.
Now we're living in a world where we're merely waiting for him to shoot another.
And maybe it's just the first time it's been publicised, John.
That is entirely possible.
He must have practised. He must have at least shot someone dressed as a whale.
Apparently.
He must have at least practiced by harpooning a couple of overweight babushkas in a swimming pool.
Apparently, he shot a grey whale with a crossbow while riding in a rubber raft. Why did he do it? Does that really matter?
Self-defence, John. It was self-defence.
That's right. It was him or the whale. He's the Russian
Ahab. Whale was tooled up.
Yeah. Is the fact that he shot a whale with a crossbow not enough for everyone? Is that not plenty to get us all through the coming week? If ever things feel like they're getting on top of you this week, just remember that you live in a world where Vladimir Putin shoots whales with crossbows. It's not that bad a life. Putin, apparently, dressed in a black and orange waterproof suit and a black beanie, held his balance in a rubber boat that was being tossed around in very choppy waters off the Chukotka Peninsula, and eventually hit the whale with a special arrow designed to collect skin samples before screaming, "I hit it at the fourth try," at a camera crew on the shore. I mean, this is just the latest in a long line of heroic moments that, you know, I believe we've discussed at length regarding Putin. And it seems that with Putin, this is no longer a political career. It's a soft porn calendar. I'll take you through the months now. January, Putin in a plane. Because during the recent wildfires in Russia, he piloted a plane over an affected area, dropping gallons of water upon it before landing and pronouncing it a direct hit. February, posing topless with a horse. He did that. Just Google Putin, topless, and horse, and see why this image is going to represent the month that features Valentine's Day. March, swimming with dolphins, just to show his sensitive side. April, shooting a tiger, which he did. He protected a camera crew last year from a charging tiger by shooting it. There's no photo of this event, but you could do a phenomenal watercolour picture of it. May, swimming in a frozen Siberian lake. June, riding a Harley Davidson through Ukraine. All things he's done. And July to December, pictures of him shooting a whale with a crossbow from six different angles. He really does raise the question, Andy. Yep. Deep down, what do we want from our politicians? Do we want them to be, you know, intelligent legislators? Or do we really just want them to make us feel safe? Do we want them swearing into office really looking like they're on the cover of a romance novel? Maybe David Cameron should get long extensions for his hair and some pec implants, just to make those budget cuts seem slightly less painful.
Well, I think certainly Gordon Brown would probably have won the election in May had he turned up to one of the TV debates wearing just the bottom half of a wetsuit with a crossbow slung over his shoulder and a mouthful of blubber.
He would! He would, though! Because we thought, wow, he's... I just feel better when he's around.
And certainly, you know, the Pakistan government, if they were out there shooting whales with crossbows, yeah, you know, it wouldn't do any practical good.
No.
But it would be a source of inspiration to their beleaguered people, John. Bugle feature section now, the CIA. Well, there's a couple of very interesting stories about the CIA this week, John. But unfortunately, I'm not going to tell you about them because I'm afraid... I have been interfered with by the CIA themselves.
Really?
When it started innocently enough a couple of days ago, they came to my gig and silently heckled me. But I could hear it in my head.
Okay. You know.
And then they replaced my lovely little son, 18 months old now, with a screaming banshee timed to go off at 4 a.m. with no snooze button. So rather than getting up early this morning to write some jokes lampooned on the CIA, John, I spent an hour and a half walking a stroppy boy around the streets of Edinburgh looking for buses for him to point at and trying to avoid drunken student actors wondering why they were chundering into a bin instead of being on a plane to Hollywood after getting a 3-star review in the Stenhouse Muir Stonker and 4 stars in the notoriously overgenerous Jewish Aunt and Mother-in-Law Monthly. So I'm afraid the CIA have stopped me addressing this story, John. By which I mean, my son, stop me addressing this story.
Well, there are two key stories this week regarding the CIA. Firstly, it turns out in 1951, a quiet, picturesque village in southern France was suddenly and mysteriously struck down with mass insanity and hallucinations. And what happened was the CIA had peppered local food with LSD as part of a mind control experiment during the height of the Cold War. The mystery of Le Pain Maudit, or cursed bread, still haunts the inhabitants of Pont-Saint-Esprit in the Gard's southeast France. This unbelievable, Andy. Hallucinogenic bread. Those French can bake. Apparently, one man tried to drown himself, screaming that his belly was being eaten by snakes. An 11-year-old tried to strangle his grandmother. That may have had nothing to do with the bread, though. Another man shouted, "I'm a plane," before jumping out of a second-floor window, breaking his legs, getting up and running for 50 yards. And another saw his heart escaping through his feet and begged a doctor to put it back. Well done, CIA. Well done.
Well, I've had some good food in France in my time, but nothing quite that good.
The other story is that the key aide to President Karzai, at the centre of a politically sensitive corruption investigation, it turns out, is being paid by the CIA. And this is nothing particularly new. Other prominent Afghans who have CIA on the corner of their paychecks every month include Karzai's own half-brother, who's suspected by investigators of playing a role in Afghanistan's booming heroin trade. But... the problem is that when things like this become public, it just doesn't sit well with the whole "we're going to root out corruption in Afghanistan" message that the White House has been pushing forward. It's contrary to Afghanistan's message of "that's right, of course you are. Now can I please have the money you promised me to say that?" The aide in question, Mr. Salehi, was arrested by the Afghan police after investigators say they wiretapped him, soliciting a bribe in the form of a car for his son, in exchange for impeding an American-backed investigation into a company suspected of shipping billions of dollars out of the country for Afghan officials, drug smugglers and insurgents. And this story takes in the delicate eco-balance of corruption that keeps Afghanistan both thriving and falling apart. When Salehi was arrested, he called, apparently, President Karzai from jail, who then sent aides to get him and has since threatened to limit the power of the anti-corruption unit that carried out the arrest. That is a good, positive, swift response, Andy. Release the man caught in the act of corruption and then restrict the power of those who caught him to do so again. Great work from the least bad option for president then. A senior Obama administration official said, corruption matters to us. The fact that Salehi might have been on our payroll does not necessarily change any of the basic issues here. No, so they don't mind him being corrupt when he's being corrupt for them, Andy. It's when he's corrupt regarding the corruption he's supposed to be corrupting that it's over the line. I think I get it.
Also, but in these day and age, you've got to be an equal opportunities employer, haven't you? And yeah. There's probably some law saying you have to employ at least 50% corrupt people in Afghanistan. I don't know if that's law or just probability. But... Your emails now, and unfortunately the CIA have told us to get out of this studio in Edinburgh within 2 minutes. So, no emails this week.
Right.
This is how your country works, John.
That's right.
Bugle Sport. No sport either, because fucking CIA. Add some gold about Jim Furyk. You're just going to have to wait till next week. Special Bugle giveaway. Another bit from my 2001 Edinburgh show. The CIA stopping me say that as well. That's for different reasons. We've had some cracking emails this week as well, so we'll do them next week instead.
Yeah.
And also next week, I promise you, the John Ruskin sketch. The sketch that drove my wife to tears of frustration. But, you know, 200 people laughing at it over the course of an entire month cannot be wrong, John. They cannot be wrong. That's it, Buglers. Do keep your emails coming in to thebugle@timesonline.co.uk. And thanks again to all of those who have been to see the show, particularly the man who'd flown 21 hours on 4 separate flights just to get there.
Wow.
Hero. A hero, John.
Hero Bugler. But have a lovely week, Buglers. We'll be back next week, CIA permitting. And if there's a clicking sound at the end of this bugle, the CIA are listening to you.
John, it sounds like you've got a red dot on your forehead.
Ha! Get off!